Hi friends, before we jump into today's episode, I want to thank you for choosing to listen to the surprising rebirth of Belief in God. We'll soon be celebrating 500,000 downloads since launch and winning a Zenga Prize for podcast journalism. If you're enjoying the series and you'd like to help me reach even more people with thinking faith, can I encourage you to support this podcast? Becoming a silver supporter means you get early access to episodes and bonus content. Gold supporters also get signed books and a monthly catch-up with me on Zoom, if you'd like it. The links to support are with the show notes, or visit justinbriley.com. Enjoy today's episode.
Ah, Hastings. How else could Monsieur Saunders reserve for himself a room next door to Monsieur Operson? He had to assume a new identity.
How could you possibly know?
As ever, Monsieur, it was the little details, the matters of no consequence that caught the attention of Poirot.
The actor David Suchet is most recognised for playing the role of Hercule Poirot. His portrayal of the plump Belgian detective became the definitive on-screen incarnation of the character for nearly 25 years across 70 TV and film adaptations of Agatha Christie's novels. What many people don't know is that he's also a committed Christian. Even fewer know the story of his adult conversion. When I spoke to him for a profile interview during my time as editor of Premier Christianity magazine, he told me how, growing up in a nominally religious household, none of it had stuck. The nearest he'd come to religious practice was a fleeting interest in Eastern spirituality.
We were very much influenced in the 60s, late 50s and 60s, by the Beatles, by the Rolling Stones, by everybody looking for spiritual enlightenment. Mm. And they used to go off to India, didn't they? They used to go off to their gurus.
Yeah.
And suddenly the Church of England, or Christianity in the Church of England, was slightly sidelined as people romantically looked towards the East for their religion, forgetting, of course, that Christianity was an Eastern faith.
By the mid-80s, Suchet had developed a successful career both on stage as an actor in the Royal Shakespeare Company and playing action movie bad guys.
Jump cut to 1986, when I'm making a film in America. Lying in the bath, thinking about the man who transformed, well, not transformed, but has been the biggest influence of my life, which was my late grandfather, James Jarche. He was for me, and still is, very much alive, and was at that time almost my guide. I used to talk to him. And I was lying in the bath in a hotel room in Seattle. And I suddenly started thinking about the afterlife, because I said to myself, I don't believe in the afterlife. Why? There's nothing to prove that there is an afterlife. And then I thought, well, why am I thinking about and talking to my grandfather who's dead if I don't believe he's alive? And I thought, well, you know, why don't I believe in the afterlife? And I don't believe in the afterlife because I certainly don't believe in Jesus.
Eureka moments happen in bathtubs, and it was this thought that led Suchet to get hold of a Bible and begin to investigate its claims. As far as Christianity was concerned, he wasn't even sure if Jesus was a strictly historical figure or not. However, from his dimly remembered divinity lessons, he recalled that the Apostle Paul had written some letters, so he started there.
I started reading the letter to the Romans, because I'm fascinated by Rome, always been fascinated by Rome, and the Roman Empire and everything like that. I'd already been in the RSC, and I know, for me, the best way to read a classical play that's been around for centuries, to read it afresh, is to imagine that I'm reading the first draft.
Yes.
So I thought, well, the Bible's been, this letter's been around for about 2,000 years, but I'm not going to read it as scripture. I'm going to read it as a letter.
Good, okay.
So, for the first time, but it's addressed to me, not to the Romans, it's addressed to David. But from 8 onwards, I suddenly found a way of being and a way of existing and a way of thinking and behaving and caring and looking at the world in a completely different way.
Years later, Suchet would go on to record the complete NIV audio Bible, including the passages from Romans that spoke so powerfully to him.
Romans chapter 8. Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit who gives life has set you free from the law of sin and death.
By the end of it, by the end of that letter, I was very moved, very emotional. I believed I had found what I had been, if you like, under the surface looking for in the 60s and the 70s. Yeah. And now in the mid-80s, this is what I wanted to be. This I had found.
Right.
Forget the gurus, forget everything. I'd found a way of being, that, as he describes the Christian life in the later chapters of Romans.
Absolutely,
Mind you, I'm in good company. Augustine was also converted by Rome and many others. Possibly the most influential letter for conversion ever written.
Absolutely,
However, I had a problem. A big problem presented to me. Because if you remember, I have just said I didn't believe in Jesus Christ.
Indeed.
So how did Paul find out what he was writing about? Jesus Christ. So that took me to the Gospels.
Okay.
Because I now had to find out who was responsible for making Paul write this way.
And so,
and that was the beginning.
Paul introduced you to the person
of
Jesus.
Paul introduced me to the person of Jesus, who I disbelieved.
In reading the Gospels, Suchet discovered the magnetic personality and sublime teachings of Jesus Christ, captured in a historically robust set of documents which, even at 2,000 years' distance, were still capable of bringing a sceptic to the point of conversion. Suchet was baptized soon after. Today, as we conclude Act 4 on the surprising rebirth of belief in the Bible, we'll meet those who are wondering afresh whether the Jesus of history may also be the living Jesus of today. I'm Justin Brierley, and throughout my working life, I've been hosting conversations on faith between atheists, agnostics, and believers. In this documentary series, I'm telling the story of why new atheism grew old and secular thinkers are considering Christianity again. I'm speaking to those inside and outside the atheist movement and the many new thinkers beginning a new conversation on the value of faith. Along the way, we'll meet some of those who have found themselves surprised by God as they've made the journey from atheism to Christianity. Welcome to The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Episode 16. Did the resurrection really happen? Just before we jump into the rest of today's show, one of the voices you'll hear on this podcast is friend of the show, Glenn Scrivener, a brilliant Christian communicator. Glenn has recently put together an online course called 321. It's an introduction to Christianity that's imaginative, stimulating, and assumes no prior knowledge. If you've been thinking about exploring faith for yourself, or if you want something to share with your friends, 321 is just the thing. Glenn presents 8 video-led sessions which are beautifully shot and animated. I found it a really engaging and practical way of connecting the big ideas in this podcast to our everyday life. I'm already thinking of people I can share it with. See for yourself at 321course.com/JB. It's completely free. Just start a free account with your email and a password and you're in. There's no spam, no hidden costs. Go to 321course.com/JB and discover life according to Jesus.
But I think as time rolls on, people are going to understand the need to have some sort of divine structure to things, some sort of belief in the sanctity of love and of truth. And a lot of that comes from religion.
This is Joe Rogan, host of the most popular podcast in the world, talking recently with a guest about faith.
a lot of people's moral compass and the guidelines that they've used to follow to live a just and righteous life has come from religion. And unfortunately, a lot of very intelligent people, they dismiss all of the positive aspects of religion because they think that the stories are mere superstitious fairy tales, that, you know, they have no place in this modern world, and, you know, we're inherently good and your ethics are based on your old moral compass and we all have one, and that's not necessarily true. We need Jesus. I think, for real. Like, if he came back now, it'd be great. Like, Jesus, if you're thinking about coming back
right now,
now's a good time.
Yeah, pretty soon. Yeah,
now's a good time.
The idea of Joe Rogan saying this kind of thing 10 or more years ago, when his talk show was hosting many new atheist thinkers, would have been hard to imagine. Something seems to have changed in the atmosphere, and I suspect one of his frequent guests in recent years may have something to do with it.
And so it isn't that the Bible is true. It's that the Bible is the precondition for the manifestation of truth, which makes it way more true than just true. It's a whole different kind of true. And I think this is not only literally the case, factually, I think it can't be any other way. It's the only way we can solve the problem of perception.
This is hugely popular psychologist and author Jordan Peterson, appearing on the Joe Rogan Experience in 2022, explaining why everything in our culture, even the very way we think and perceive life, stands downstream of the Bible.
So now imagine you have an aggregation of texts in a civilization. You say, which are the fundamental texts? And the answer is, the texts upon which most other texts depend. And so you'd put Shakespeare way in there in English, because so many texts are dependent on Shakespeare's literary revelations. And Milton would be in that category, and Dante would be in that category, at least in translation. Fundamental authors, part of the Western canon, not because of the arbitrary dictates of power, but because those texts influenced more other texts. And then you think about that as a hierarchy, okay, with the Bible at its base, which is certainly the case.
As we've explored before in this series, Peterson has had an outsized influence on his audience in terms of taking the Bible, and in turn Christian faith, seriously again, even as he has remained somewhat enigmatic when it comes to his personal beliefs about God. Perhaps one of the moments he came closest to making a statement of faith was in this interview, when he became emotional, speaking about how the Jesus revealed in Scripture may be more than just a great archetype in a hierarchy of values.
There's a historical representation of his existence as well. Now, you can debate whether or not that's genuine. You can debate about whether or not he actually lived and whether there's credible objective evidence for that, but it doesn't matter in some sense because of this. Well, it does, but there's a sense in which it doesn't matter because there's still a historical story. And so what you have in the figure of Christ is an actual person who actually lived, plus a myth. And in some sense, Christ is the union of those two things. The problem is I probably believe that. But I don't know. I'm amazed at my own belief, and I don't understand it. Like, because I've seen sometimes the objective world and the narrative world touch. You know, that's Jungian synchronicity. And I've seen that many times in my own life.
The person Peterson was having this conversation with is Jonathan Pageau, an Eastern Orthodox icon carver and Christian thinker who, as a fellow Canadian, got to know Peterson before his rise to fame.
I think the second time that I met him at his house, when he was driving me back to the bus station because I was taking the bus home, I looked him in the eyes, I said, "Jordan, you're going to bring back Christianity." And he kind of looked at me and he answered, "Well, I hope that I can help people understand the psychological significance of the Bible story." And in my mind at that moment, I thought, all right, we've got two courses. Let's see which one plays out, you know. And that was in 2016. So that's a long time ago.
I recently sat down with Pajot, who hosts his own very popular Symbolic World podcast, to talk about how his own theological take on the Bible as a source of deep symbolism for the patterns of meaning we encounter in life has increasingly influenced public figures like Peterson, Joe Rogan, and more. I asked him why he believes a purely material story of reality can't account for the meaning behind things.
At the origin of something, there's always a mystery. This is actually how the world works. Like, it's whether you try to put your mystery all the way back into the Big Bang and you think, well, can't account for that, but I'll account for everything downstream from it. You know, it's like, that's how actually reality works. You always, at the outset, is a miracle of all worlds, is something that you cannot completely account for in the world that it gives birth to. You need a miracle at the outset, a miracle that cannot be completely accounted for. And it's like, if I'm going to pick a miracle, I'll pick the resurrection, because that miracle explains everything. Explains way more than the Big Bang, by the way. The Big Bang doesn't explain much about why we live the way we live and why we care about the things we care about and why we have this hierarchy of values and why we sacrifice things and why, like, the Big Bang explains nothing of those things. But the resurrection explains all of it. The resurrection explains everything that makes society function, all the mysteries about how unity and multiplicity function together, you know, the revealing the idea that the world is held by self-emptying, that mystery itself, the idea that you do have to sacrifice something, but you sacrifice yourself, like all these things, that's actually how the world works. It is how the world works. I don't know what to say.
The thing that I've noticed, and I think you probably have noticed as well, Jonathan, is that you are seeing interesting secular thinkers kind of moving away from that new atheist phase and pointing people back towards Christianity, kind of very aware, I think, of the way the Enlightenment has sort of failed us, the way that a materialist outlook just isn't answering people's most fundamental questions. And you know, when it comes to the Bible, for instance, you've got a lot of people talking very sympathetically, like Jordan Peterson, about its psychological and cultural significance. You could also talk about the historian Tom Holland, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, you know, former new atheist herself who recently embraced Christianity, Jonathan Haidt, John Vervaeke, all these names of, you know, secular psychologists who are also saying, no, religion can be really good for us. The Bible's got a lot going for it. I guess that's great. And but I always have this slight hesitation that is ultimately, is that what that comes down to, about saying this is really psychologically useful? It's a kind of useful fiction. You know, Jesus is a wonderful archetype of heroism, sacrifice, beauty, love. And then the question is, but, well, does it make any difference then whether he actually rose from the dead? And I suppose that's the ultimate question a lot of people wanted to ask Jordan Peterson or yourself. You know, is it symbolism all the way down, or does it have a kind of material historical bedrock that also needs to be there at some level?
Yeah. Well, what you see in these types of characters and this type of approach where they'll see it as a useful fiction, it just means that they haven't gone all the way to the end, the conclusion of what their thinking implies. Because these patterns that we talk about, the question is, are they the pattern of reality or are they not the pattern of reality? And we can no longer justify the idea that there is a psychological pattern of reality and then there's a material pattern of reality, and those are arbitrarily separated from each other and have nothing to do with each other. That's actually, even from almost like a materialist point of view, it's a ridiculous idea to have. Whereas if we actually formulate complexity at every level using similar patterns, that's a far more coherent way of looking at reality. It's like there's multiplicity and there's unity. So once you think that, then the pattern of death and resurrection just is one of the patterns of reality. And so why would it have to be a useful fiction? It's just annoying. It's like, because everything about your world is based on that pattern. You know, whether it's even the pattern of attention, of forgetting, of remembering, of sleeping, of waking, you know, of desires cycling back and forth. Like, all of our experience is about the movement into unity and the movement into multiplicity, right? This kind of breakdown and this return. That's just how attention functions. And that's how the world functions. So if I tell you a story that happened in the world in the way that is the most true the most concentrated, the one that brings it all together into an event that explains everything else, then the idea that it's a useful fiction, it's like, why does it bother you that it happened? Because that's the pattern of reality. It is the pattern of reality. It's not, the pattern of reality is no longer this 19th century materialist, like arbitrary things bumping into each other. We just cannot abide by that anymore. So to me, that's what it shows. It shows that a lot of the people that are on that bridge, they're on the bridge. They haven't stepped completely into the consequences of their thinking.
Pajot is among a number of notable thinkers pointing to the foundational relevance of the Bible in our culture. Douglas Murray, who has described himself as a Christian atheist, is concerned at what our culture is losing without the Christian story.
But I see what people are struggling to do, which is to try to maintain and hold on to this exceptionally important gift of the Christian inheritance. Without the idea of equality in the eyes of God and the value of every individual in the eyes of God, you are left with these attempts to assert that, for instance, everyone is the same. And it's clear that we can't be and that we aren't.
In a big conversation I hosted for Premier Unbelievable between Murray and New Testament scholar N.T. Wright, he spoke at some length about why, even as a non-believer, he couldn't shake the centrality of the book that Western culture is founded upon.
I remember some years ago reading a very interesting a book by George Steiner, in which he relayed a conversation he said was one of the most important conversations he had in his life, which was actually in South Africa, which Tom just referred to. I hope I don't get it wrong. It's in one of his later books. But Steiner says that late one night over dinner, he's talking with some activists, happen to be black activists, and I suppose it must have been still in apartheid time. And one of them says to him something, to Steiner, who's obviously Jewish, but you don't understand, we don't have a book. And Steiner said it was one of the most flooring and distressing things he had ever heard. We don't have a book. Now, obviously, these people were not Christian. But what they noticed was they did not have a thing to draw upon in the same way that, for instance, Steiner, although he wasn't exactly a believing a Jew, I think, had the Torah. There's a similar point made by Alan Bloom in one of his books in the 1980s. I can't remember which one. Where he says, if you're not going to have the Bible, you would need to have a book of equivalent seriousness to base it all on. And I've always thought this is a very important challenge, because there are books that people might put forward, try to base it on, but they are never of equivalent seriousness. And it's actually quite hard to think of a book of equivalent seriousness to the Bible. But I do think this is a challenge. What would you base it all on?
It's fascinating because A.C. Grayling, maybe 10 years ago, produced that thing called The Good Book, which was his attempt to do a sort of secular Bible, and it fell flat on its face.
Yeah.
It was a very shallow and rather distressing production. But the Christian, the point of the Christian Bible is, yes, it's a book which does this, that, and the other. It's a great story, but the Christian Bible, the climax of the story is, of course, Jesus. The four Gospels bring the story of Israel to an unexpected and very shocking climax, as a result of which all sorts of other things happen. So it isn't that the Bible is just full of abstract teachings and ethics, etc., and, oh yeah, we've got this book which tells us what to do. It's a story, and you're invited to get on board with the story and to be part of the onward movement that takes it forward from there. And the Christian Bible has that climax on Jesus. And if you take that away, well, it's a lovely idea, but why should we credit it?
I really appreciated Tom Wright's addendum to Murray's thoughts there. In the end, the story of Scripture can only make a real difference if it is rooted in real history, a real person, a real set of events. The crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus is the climax of that story. Of course, this climactic story does find significant echoes in other mythological stories. But, says mythologist and storyteller Martin Shaw, there are also some significant differences.
And just to clear something up in terms of mythology in Christ, what you get from skeptics is they will tell you that there's a kind of infrastructure to Christ's life that you find in, say, Odin or Egyptian gods, or maybe even in Dionysus. Now, here's the thing. There is an architecture which you can recognize. What you have that is completely unique in the life of Jesus is where the rubber hits the road is what he said. It's what he taught. It's what he went through. There are no other gods like that. There's no other god that has a dog in the race like our one. And so that's the important thing. It is, and Lewis and Tolkien would agree with this, it's as if you're getting divine glimpses. It's like warm-up events, pinpricks of eternity through other spiritualities and mythologies that suddenly breaks into time and space in a way we understand, and you get this extraordinary thing happen. But you've got to be careful because there's a resurgence of interest, for example, in Jungian psychology, partly through Jordan Peterson and others. That's all well and good, and I know it back to front. But Christ is not an archetype, just to be clear. He's not just a figure. He's not this just sort of, he has opinions, he has thoughts, he struggles. We have to deal as Christians with the strangeness that he's completely human and completely God, and all of that is going on. So one of the concerns, I think, as the wider conversations opens, is not to thin him out to a point where he just becomes a sort of, you know, one of a tapestry of interesting figures.
Yes.
Otherwise, there's no point in that.
I think Peterson struggles to disentangle himself from the impulse to psychologize religious belief, to think of religion as man's search for God.
This is Christian journalist and author Bethel McGrew expanding on some of Martin Shaw's concerns.
There's this sense in which he takes religious stories extremely seriously because he views them as a precondition for knowledge itself, in a way. He doesn't believe that we can function or form behavioral patterns at all without being guided by stories. And the stories of the Bible, Cain and Abel, Moses, Noah, are some of our first stories, our first memories as a species. But all of this is still viewing religion as man's search for God, when really it's God's search for man. That's the fundamental shift that he needs to make in his thinking. And I don't know if he's made it yet, because in a way it would really kind of flip his project upside down. And I think, like Douglas Murray, like Tom Holland, he still struggles with a certain kind of stock narrative of religious history. You had intellectually fulfilled Christianity, but then came the Enlightenment, then came Darwin, then came all of these things we've learned that we can't unlearn. That stock Enlightenment narrative about all the things we can't unlearn still remains very entrenched. And I think at this point in time, it would really take a radical multidisciplinary sea change to dislodge and deprogram that narrative in the academy, in the institutions. And because that's how all these thinkers have been trained. They all sincerely believe that's the narrative you have to accept if you're intellectually honest. And if you reject it, then you must have a subjective reason for it. You must just be sort of reaching for Christianity as kind of a security blanket. So I think this is our challenge. As Christians, you know, we have these people they don't have integrated minds. So to the extent that they believe a return to faith is possible, I think they believe it has to be, in essence, non-intellectual. It has to be a leap of faith in spite of the evidence.
Like Bethel McGrew, I've also seen many of these seeking intellectuals describe coming to actually believe the claims of the Bible as a leap of faith. But like her, I think it's more about changing the filter through which you read the story. As we'll hear later, I don't think claims of the supernatural are at odds with reason, just so long as we haven't made the mistake of defining reason as something that excludes the supernatural. Some years ago, Bethel, using a pen name Esther O'Reilly at the time, joined me on Premier Unbelievable with Douglas Murray, Towards the end of our conversation, I raised the question of what it would take to turn Murray from Christian atheist to, well, just Christian. What would it take for you personally to kind of make that journey back to see the tide come in again? Is it just a really long chat with Esther where she convinces you of the reliability of the Gospels, or is there a bit more to it?
I think I'd need to hear a voice.
What kind? A voice from beyond.
I mean it literally.
Okay.
By the way, I'm very interested in the absence of this sort of discussion within the religious discussion. It strikes me that that's not in the mix at all in what people are discussing about Western Christianity. And when I say that, as I say, I assume that religious people will think I'm trying to lead them into some trap. I'm not. I'm saying that is and has historically been one of the ways in which the Christian religion has thrived.
I mean, Esther, Douglas is looking for some kind of experience and he says maybe we should expect a bit more of it.
I'm saying that the bar is that high.
The bar is that high. Okay, fair enough. What's your response to that, Esther?
Well, I mean, I put in mind of Ebenezer Scrooge a bit. You know, should you have such an experience, one could always, you know, like if a voice spoke to Peter Atkins, he would say that it was just a bit of undigested potato, you know? And I can personally say I have never heard voices or a voice. That's not an experience that I've been given. Although, as Douglas points out, one does hear stories sometimes in the less developed countries, Africa, the Middle East. You do frequently hear stories, for example, of Muslims who say, Jesus visited me in a dream and said, why are you persecuting me? And now I'm a Christian. So those are quite interesting stories that you might want to have a look at. But what I should say is I would disagree that the bar should be set that high, because I would say, you know, if we were convinced that this was true, that the truth claims were true, that Christ had become incarnate, had died, had ministered, healed the sick, raised the dead, and then in the end risen himself from the dead, if we could be convinced of those things, it, you know, much the same way we're convinced of anything in history, then I don't see why we shouldn't believe it, even if we never heard voices.
I should stress, I'm not by any means saying that people shouldn't believe it if they haven't heard, if they haven't got to that level of evidential proof that I'm saying. And I should stress, I'm not even saying that I haven't set my bar that high, you know.
Okay.
Saying that at this stage, that is what it would require as I see it at the moment. That isn't to say that it couldn't be satisfied lower, but that's just my instinct when asked what would be needed. Mm. I suppose one thing that often holds, let's say, intellectuals back is, can I make this leap in a way that is intellectually satisfiable, or at least can I do it in a way that allows me not to have to volunteer up, you know, even a part of my sense of intellectual honesty or self-worth or self-esteem, as it were. And that isn't the way, that genuinely isn't the way in which I view this. If I could, I would, but I can't.
Okay.
And I would just add to that, I mean, I was in Israel again earlier this year and traveled around Galilee a lot in particular. And I came back and a friend who recently converted to Catholicism in recent years said to me, you know, what did you feel anything?
Yeah.
And I said to him, you know, some very private thought I had, but I said, I did on that trip to Galilee in particular, I did end up having one sentence in my head that I couldn't get out, which was, something happened here. Something happened here.
Something happened here. I believe that something did happen 2,000 years ago that put flesh and bones on all the symbolism, meaning, and enduring influence that so many are willing to attribute to the story of Jesus' incarnation, life, death, and resurrection. C.S. Lewis, a famous convert from atheism himself, described it as myth become fact. And in that vein, in the rest of today's episode, we'll explore the case for why many people believe it is perfectly reasonable for intelligent, rational, 21st century citizens of the West to believe that Jesus really did rise again.
Then Balliol, 1997. I think you started a year later, do you?
Yes, 98, I retreated. Yeah.
This is me catching up with James Orr, who I had overlapped with as an undergraduate at Balliol College, Oxford University, in the late 90s.
So Balliol was Balliol.
Just remind me what you were reading at the time.
Classic, sorry. Yes.
Right, hence the Greek, yes.
Absolutely, I loved, so this is an important, this would become an important detail. I absolutely loved classics, so... Latin and Greek literature, Latin and Greek history, ancient philosophy, and was very only dimly aware of Christian life at Oxford, which it was a very vibrant Christian scene, of course, but it passed me by almost...
Well, it depends what world you live in, doesn't it? Like all these things, if you live in the sort of amateur dramatic world,
yeah.
that seems like the main thing in Oxford, but if you don't live in that world, you miss it, you know. Yeah,
absolutely.
Interestingly, James Orr, myself, and Douglas Murray were all undergraduates at the same time at Oxford University. I had arrived as a Christian and left as a Christian. Douglas Murray arrived with some Christian beliefs, but lost them soon after. James, on the other hand, arrived as a non-believer who, by the time he left Oxford, was on a journey towards Christianity. His public school education had involved attending chapel, but it hadn't had much effect on him. He was fairly agnostic towards Christianity. At an academic level, he excelled. Having studied Greek and Latin, James was fairly fluent in reading Greek by the time he arrived at university for his degree in classics. Up to that point, James says he'd only read the ancient works of the great playwrights and philosophers that were part of his reading list. But one day, a Christian friend gave James a copy of the New Testament in its original language, Greek.
It was like a sort of lightning rod, I suppose. I became aware that this text was anchored in history. If you had asked me before, where did I think it had come from? I don't know. I mean, I didn't sort of think it was a sort of fantasy text. I mean, I'd heard it being read, but somehow it occupied a part of my imagination that was siloed off from history in some sense, siloed off from the warp and woof of everyday life and the concrete processes of history. I think I just had never really given a moment's thought that this was a product of whatever its veracity and historicity. This was a product of a particular community, and somebody once upon a time wrote it.
That's kind of understandable, because I think it's one of the unfortunate side effects of the fact that we do treat the Bible in a sense as a quote unquote religious text. And so most people see it as living in this,
yes,
you know, a church on a pulpit and essentially for moral guidance, and hardly ever actually think of the other side of it, which is actually it is obviously a historical book as well.
Absolutely right. It sort of occupied a sort of sacred silo, and its sacred status, as it were, sealed it off from my critical scrutiny. And that just then seeing those first words jump off the page, it was like, well, wait, my gosh, hold on. This is a text written in the language at the same time as texts that I am studying in my tutorials and evaluating in historical terms and not dismissing out of hand. This is where the double standards point comes in.
Mm.
There I sort of started to think, well, hold on, that does mean that I've got to start thinking about this text. The question of its historicity began to impose itself on me.
Did you know this podcast is also a book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again, is available now. Historian Tom Holland says Justin has had a ringside seat watching the great debates on religion and reports on them with learning, subtlety, and grace. Now, don't tell anyone, but you'll actually get the first chapter free in your email inbox if you subscribe to my newsletter. Or if you want to just go ahead and order, signed editions are available from my website. Or even better, you'll get both my books personally signed when you become a gold supporter of this podcast. So for the newsletter, the book, or to support, check the links in the show notes or visit justinbriley.com. Encountering the real historical records of a Jesus who really lived and of whom miracles and even a resurrection were claimed would eventually impact James Orr's life in some very surprising ways. We'll return to his story at the end of the episode. I believe that there is a strong case to be made that the claim of Jesus's first followers, that he had been raised from the dead, is the best explanation of the historical data we have about the events in question. Here's a Christian thinker, William Lane Craig, giving a brief summary of some of the key historical facts to atheist podcast host Alex O'Connor.
I think my listeners will be broadly familiar, so perhaps without going into too much depth, just bullet pointing, what are the main points of evidence that you would direct people's attention to say these are reasons to think that a man rose from the dead on Easter morning?
First, I would say, what are the facts to be explained? And those would include things like the death of Jesus of Nazareth by Roman crucifixion during Passover around AD 30. Second, his burial or interment in a tomb by a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Sanhedrin named Joseph of Arimathea. Thirdly, the discovery by a group of his female followers on the Sunday morning after the crucifixion that tomb was empty. Fourth would be that thereafter various individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death. And then the last one would be that the earliest disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead despite having every predisposition to the contrary. And then I would ask the question, if those are the facts of the case, and the wide majority of scholars agree with all five of those points, then the question is, how do you best explain them? And I can't think of a better explanation than the one that the original disciples gave. When you assess these explanations in terms of the standard criteria for being a good historical explanation, things like explanatory power, explanatory scope, plausibility, degree of ad hocness, consistency with other beliefs, and so on and so forth.
Some scholars have labeled the kinds of evidences outlined by Craig here as minimal facts, i.e. a set of data points that the majority of scholars of ancient history in this area, whether they consider themselves believers or not, or whether they believe the Bible is a divinely inspired book or not, whether they believe in miracles or not, they all agree are well-established historical facts. Now, whether it's these so-called minimal facts, or we believe we could add many more aspects of the New Testament records for a maximal account of the events, I've at least found it helpful to understand that we must take seriously the New Testament, not just as a set of religious texts, but as historical accounts. Here's historian John Dixon of the Undeceptions podcast expanding on some of these commonly accepted historical facts.
The tomb in which Jesus had been laid was very probably found empty. That's a conclusion reached by people not just those who believe the gospel, but who don't, but still study the history. And there are a few reasons there is this pretty close to consensus about an empty tomb. The first is that it's mentioned in three separate sources. That's sources that haven't been copied from one another. Secondly, we have pretty good evidence that the elites in Jerusalem claimed that the disciples of Jesus stole the body from the tomb, which tells us all these years later that they accepted there must have been an empty tomb. They just disputed how it got that way. And the third reason most scholars think there was an empty tomb is that the account of the discovery of the empty tomb centers on women. That is, women were the first to know about the empty tomb and the resurrection. Our gospel, in the opening line of our passage today, strikes that theme. We hear that Mary Magdalene went to the disciples, straight from the empty tomb, with the news, I have seen the Lord. And she told them that he had said these things to her. For historians, this is really significant. And you find the same thing in the other three Gospels. Women were the key witnesses of the empty tomb.
The fact that women are described in all four gospel accounts as the first discoverers of the empty tomb helps to establish the historical truth of the story by what is sometimes termed the criterion of embarrassment. In an age where the testimony of a woman was worth far less than that of a man, it wasn't the kind of detail a writer would include if they were trying to fabricate a convincing story. It was embarrassing to have to include it, but its inclusion now points to the veracity of the story. The role of women in the story is something that Lisa Fields, a Christian apologist and founder of the Jude 3 Project, told me she has found helpful.
And one particular, I guess, apologetic one that I love when it comes to the resurrection is the fact that the New Testament writer documents that the first person to tell that Jesus was risen was a woman, and how women weren't in that day believed. And so it is actually a kind of proof of the resurrection that if women told the story, that the writers weren't actually lying, because if they were trying to lie, they would have said a man actually had the message. And so that's one, as being a woman in ministry, that I love, because it shows like God values women and God uses women in very unique ways, especially when you compare the resurrection account and Eve and how the enemy used Eve to deceive man. But Jesus used Mary to redeem man by sharing the gospel through a woman. And so all of that, I think, encourages me when I think about the resurrection.
Back to John Dixon as he opens up another widely accepted historical fact.
But of course, an empty tomb can be explained in a number of ways. And so it's really a second piece of information that historians really puzzle over that kind of amps up how seriously they take the resurrection. From the beginning, people claimed in good faith to be eyewitnesses of the risen Jesus. Our evidence for their being eyewitnesses to these events, or at least claimed eyewitnesses, is very strong. And there are kind of three reasons it's taken seriously, even by secular scholars. The first reason is that the testimony we have about people claiming to see the Lord is firsthand. I mean, John's Gospel is a good example. This is actually written by an eyewitness. We have firsthand testimony. The second reason is that it's very early. This was not written hundreds of years after the fact. In fact, John's Gospel, which is usually considered one of the later of the New Testament documents, was still written very close in time to the events themselves, closer in time to Jesus than our best biography is written in comparison to Emperor Tiberius, who ruled at the same time as Jesus. But you've got to wait nearly 80 years to get a biography of Tiberius. That's the one written by Tacitus. But in the case of the Gospel of John, it's much earlier. We have much earlier documents than that. In fact, we have this extraordinary little statement that most scholars think was composed within months or maybe just a few years of the events. But basically it says, "For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Peter and then to the 12. It's early. And thirdly, the evidence is sincere. When you dip into the academic literature, one of the striking things is most experts, even very secular ones, are pretty convinced the original witnesses were sincere, that they gave us their testimony in good faith. And the reason they think this is very straightforward. These original witnesses gained nothing from their testimony.
That Bible reference read out by John Dixon was from 1 Corinthians 15, one of the Apostle Paul's letters to the first Christian communities. Paul is quoting a very early creed, a statement of beliefs about the death and resurrection of Christ and the various people and groups who claim to be witnesses to it. As Dixon says, historians believe this creedal statement goes right back to perhaps within months of the events themselves. In historical terms, this is like hitting the jackpot. It also means there's no room here for the common misconception that the resurrection story grew over a long period of time through multiple retellings into a legendary and highly embellished piece of hearsay. There simply isn't enough time for that process to happen. The belief that Jesus was physically raised from the dead was present among the first Christians from the very outset and was based on the accounts of those who said they had met him.
Justin, if we wanted to invent a resurrection narrative or indeed even a new religion in the first century, we never would have done it the way the gospel writers did it. They opened themselves up to such attack, such ridicule.
This is Jeremiah J. Johnston, New Testament scholar and author of Body of Proof, The Seven Best Reasons to Believe in the Resurrection of Jesus and Why It Matters Today. He told me why there was simply no psychological or theological motivation for the Jewish followers of Jesus to invent a story about an executed but now resurrected Messiah.
Judaism is a coherent religion, which means they believed in a general resurrection someday. Now, certainly not all Jews, but most of them did. The Pharisees did. Jesus taught, came out of the tradition of Pharisaic teaching. The Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection, but most Jews did. Even the Essene, or what you might refer to as Qumran community. We see this reflected in 4Q 285 and other scrolls that they were expecting a Messiah to come, and they were expecting a general vindicated resurrection in the future someday. And so think about it. If you and I were observant Jews, Justin, and we were disciples of Jesus, we could have just said he was a great rabbi. He was a great teacher. After all, I could point you to rabbis who are very well respected, who are remembered well in history. They're remembered well in the Mishnah. They're remembered well in rabbinic writings, but no one made them a god. No one said, hey, they died and they rose again. So there's no motivation for the disciples to invent this kind of narrative. There's no psychological motivation. They could have honored Jesus and said, hey, we'll see him someday in the general resurrection. They had no motivation to invent that narrative unless it actually happened.
And likewise, as you said, rabbis, you know, would you know, be remembered and remembered well and so on. But even other Messiah-like figures of that era, when they got crucified, when they got killed by the Romans, the last thing their followers did basically was go and claim that they'd raised from the dead. I mean, that in itself, claiming that you're not only Messiah who was killed, but killed by crucifixion, which was obviously the most shameful way anyone could die. It was a very odd thing to start claiming, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's extremely odd. In fact, in Body of Proof, we have no less than 10 what I call messianic pretenders or messianic contenders. This was really fascinating to list them off in the book. In fact, we have two Messiah-like figures who are mentioned even in the book of Acts. One went out into Egypt, into the wilderness, and had a following of 4,000. It fizzled out. This is why Gamaliel has this wisdom with the Apostle Paul and said, hey, if this Christian movement is of God, nothing can stop it. But if it's not, it's going to come to naught like all the other messianic-like movements. We have to ask ourselves, without privileging the New Testament, with critical eyes, with critical first century eyes, say, why did the Jesus movement continue when the other nine messianic-like movements from Jews in the first century fizzled out that were much stronger, by the way? They had a lot more than 120 to begin their movement. Well, it has to be something to do with the resurrection. And even skeptical scholars grant that. That's something that was fascinating to me. I continue to do work on this. I've had the opportunity now to publish over 250,000 words on the resurrection, both in the academic and the popular intersection. And I continue to be fascinated by the fact that skeptical scholars, they grant that the tomb is empty. They grant that the body wasn't stolen. They grant that even the earliest disciples had experiences of seeing Jesus alive. They're just not prepared to give an interpretation of what kind of experience it indeed was.
Another significant and widely affirmed historical fact is the conversion of skeptics to Christianity in the early years of the movement. The prime example is the Apostle Paul, who, as Saul, an enemy of the early church, persecuting and imprisoning believers, came to believe that Jesus was the Messiah after a vision of the risen Jesus on the road to Damascus. It's an episode recounted by Luke in the book of Acts and referred to on several occasions by Paul himself in his own letters. a hostile witness like Paul had to have a good reason for such an extraordinary change. He said it was the risen Jesus. But, says Jeremiah Johnston, another converted skeptic whose story we can trace in the New Testament accounts began closer to home.
I have four sons, Justin. You have sons. Now, if you have a brother, what would it take for you to believe your brother is the Son of God? I can tell you my boys, none of them think the other one is God's Messiah, the perfect, sinless Son of God. We have to ask ourselves these critical questions. And I think that Jesus, we know he had at least four brothers and two sisters. We know he had siblings. And I think that James and Jude and the other siblings of Jesus kind of chuckled themselves like, who the heck do you think you are, Jesus? You know, we see you when you wake up in the morning. And yet, it's interesting. John 7, verse 5, not even his brothers believed on him. Mark 3, his family thinks that he's out of his mind. Mark 6, literally, they're wanting to, not only is he out of his mind, they're wanting to do literally an intervention on him. His own family, outside of his mother, did not follow him. They did not believe in his messiahship until the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And we see this in 1 Corinthians 15, in that appearance tradition. There's this beautiful line, and he, Jesus, appeared to James. And everyone knew the James that they were talking about. They were talking about that skeptic brother, James. What's fascinating is Josephus, a first century historian, tells us that in AD 62, during a Roman leadership change in Jerusalem, when the high priest usurped power that he shouldn't have, he kills James, the Lord's brother, and he is stoned to death in AD 62, believing his brother is the Son of God, dying believing that. So he goes from skeptic to a pillar of the church that Paul meets with in Galatians 1, 18 and 19 to make sure he has the gospel right. Fast forward to AD 62, he's the leader of the church, and he dies believing his brother's the Messiah. We have to ask ourselves, what would cause someone to die believing that, especially those that are closest to him? And it was the evidence of the empty tomb and experiencing the resurrected Christ that was the game changer.
These, then, are several of the widely attested facts among scholars of the era, whether they're believers or not, that Jesus died by Roman crucifixion and was buried in a tomb, that the tomb was discovered empty by a group of his women followers, that people reported experiences of the risen Jesus, and that even skeptics were converted. Of course, much more could be added than just these commonly agreed upon historical points of data. As Christian scholar Lydia McGrew has been keen to emphasize, if we're simply open to treating the Gospels as generally historically reliable records, there are many more lines of evidence we can draw upon for the resurrection.
The disciples claimed, as we find in the Gospels, that they had lengthy conversations with Jesus after he had died, that they had the ability to touch him, that he ate with them on more than one occasion, that he stayed with them for several weeks. All of these things that are found in the Gospels, this is what the people, original people in a position to know, claimed. There are three possible explanations of their claiming this. One is that they were deceivers, they were lying. Another is that they were mistaken. And a third is that they were telling the truth. The context of their making these claims, which we find attested, for example, in the early chapters of Acts, shows that they knew they were risking their lives for doing this. And that really rules out that they were lying. The content of their claims, which we find in the gospel accounts themselves, shows that it's very unlikely that they were mistaken, because that's the kind of thing that you're very unlikely to be mistaken about, with these all these different groups seeing him and interacting with him in all these different ways at different times and so forth. And therefore, the best explanation of what they claimed is that they were telling the truth and Jesus was really risen from the dead.
Of all the historical facts we've briefly explored so far, the one that is perhaps the most significant of all is the fact we're still talking about Jesus today. Indeed, the fact we're still talking about him traces directly back to the unlikely but explosive growth of the early Christian community. This was, after all, a set of people who went from being a dejected and fearful group of disciples to a set of men and women willing to be beaten, persecuted, and killed for their strange and countercultural claim that a crucified Jewish Messiah had been raised from death. As theologian N.T. Wright pointed out to me on an edition of Premier Unbelievable, it transformed their own understanding of life and death in the process.
Of course, in the ancient world, there were lots of legends, lots of myths, lots of things floating around. My problem as a historian is that unless you say Jesus of Nazareth was raised from the dead, it is very, very difficult to explain historically many of the features of early Christianity. Just take what all the early Christians believed about what happens to people after their death. That's actually a very traditional thing. If you do a funeral, if you go to a family funeral, people want it to be pretty much like we've always done it, and they will say the same things as they've always done. Now, there's a whole range of opinions in the ancient world, pagan and Jewish, about what happens to people after they die. Astonishingly, in early Christianity, they all say, after we die, if we belong to Christ, we will rest, and then we will be raised from the dead on the last day to share in God's new world. That's a major revolution. Why did that happen? That breaks all the cultural norms that they came from. They all say it's because of what God did to Jesus. Now, that's just one argument out of dozens, but there are all sorts of lines pointing back which say, we know that dead bodies don't rise. They knew that dead body, you know, people sometimes say, oh, we have modern science, so we prove that resurrection can't happen. This is ridiculous. Plato knew that dead people don't rise. Homer knew that. Socrates knew that. This is not a new discovery. But they said, no, this is because God's new world, the Creator God, is launching his new world. And this is the beginning of it. The resurrection is not an isolated, bizarre event within the old world. It is the beginning event within the new world. But the new world nests within and is transforming the old world.
Of course, many alternative explanations have been put forward to explain the origin of the early Christian belief in the resurrection. From the theory that Jesus never really died, to stolen bodies, to mass hallucinations. But I've found that none of them actually fit this range of facts and data in the same way as the explanation given by those first followers, that Jesus really had come back to life. But there is, of course, one more objection we could level. Haven't you heard? Miracles don't happen.
Fair warning, there may not be room for it, you know, because he's cutting corners wherever he can. It's a,
I know, but I'll make it brief.
I'm muting myself. It won't show up in the audio. So
as soon as I start talking, you're going to mute yourself.
Already in this episode, we've met journalist Bethel McGrew and heard from her mother, Christian scholar Lydia McGrew. It's a family affair this week as we introduce Dad, Tim McGrew, a Christian philosopher. There are a few people better positioned to speak into the question of miracles and nature. So I asked Bethel to put a few questions to her father on my behalf, including a well-worn phrase often invoked at this point in a conversation about the evidence for a miracle, like the resurrection. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. It's a popular version of a longer objection to miracles raised by the 18th century skeptical philosopher David Hume. And Tim, quite rightly, wanted to make sure he was addressing the best version of the argument.
Hume has a maxim that's in the vicinity, but it's not couched exactly that way, that no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish.
Okay.
Right? So
yeah,
right. That's where Hume goes with it. So
yeah, but you know what? That's a little clucky.
It is.
And so, I think...
I'm trying to get out a sentence here.
Okay.
I've thought through an approach. You might not like it, but let me finish it, and then you can tell me what you think, okay?
I couldn't resist including some of this lovely father-daughter dynamic on the recording that Bethel sent me, with their permission, of course. Anyway, this is Tim McGrew's helpful response on the question of whether, as Hume believed, it's always more reasonable to prefer a natural explanation over a supernatural one, and whether such an approach sounds a death knell for the concept of the resurrection.
Hume's argument, if it works, will absolutely shut us off from ever believing such a thing. And that raises a really interesting question. If I take Hume's path and I am wrong, how am I going to find out? It's a one-way trapdoor, right? You go in there and then you can't get back out of that point of view, no matter what the evidence is. I think that aspect of it should worry anyone who's looking at it. Let me now unpack it a little bit and see if I can make this a little bit clearer. What Hume is trying to do, I think, can be, at least at a rough approximation, summarized like this. First thing he does is he defines a miracle. He says a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. And it's plain that what he means by that is that you can't both say that a miracle has truly occurred and say that the laws of nature are true. Either dead men stay dead or they don't. And Hume wants to set that up against the testimony to the miraculous. Then he tries to say the evidence in favor of the laws of nature is as good as it can get. After all, if it weren't, we wouldn't call them the laws of nature. But when we say it's a law of nature, we mean we've got the maximum evidence we could have from experience for them. Testimony, taken as a type of evidence, is variable. Sometimes people testify truly. Sometimes they don't. When they don't, sometimes they're just honestly mistaken. Sometimes they're dishonest and they're deceiving others. So testimony is a lower grade of evidence. And if you can't have both, and you've got the highest possible grade of evidence for the one, and you've got a somewhat lower grade of evidence for the other, well, it's clear which side is going to win. That's how Hume has set it up. And the trouble with the way that he has set it up is that every single piece of this is mistaken. So if we start with his definition, miracles are violations of the laws of nature. Well, we can't know what that means until we know what the laws of nature are. And the fact is that the laws of nature are not universal generalizations that are exceptionless. Let's take a law like the law of gravity. We accept that this mug of coffee is a heavy object, much heavier than the atmosphere around it. It falls by Newtonian equations under the effect of gravity here at the surface of the Earth. But here I am. I'm holding this cup of coffee and it isn't falling. Do we say, ah, the law of gravity is false then? No. We say something else is intervening, and the law of gravity doesn't say that all objects move like this. It says that this is how things happen unless they are interfered with by some outside force. Now, when a Christian says that a miracle has occurred, he is not saying dead men sometimes don't stay dead. He's not saying virgins are sometimes pregnant in the ordinary course of things. He's saying when nature is left to itself, dead men do stay dead, and that's why it's so remarkable that this individual is not dead, who was dead before. It's because something else is intervening in the system. Some other force, some other power is at work here, not just what nature can do by itself. So you can see immediately that if we get the right understanding of what a miracle is, we're going to reject the claim that miracles are violations of the laws of nature. They're not violations. They're invocations of the except clause. This is what happens unless. And what we're going to say is, yes, but not all else was equal here, right? Something else was happening. Something else was intervening. That's kind of the point of claiming that something is a miracle. As far as testimony is concerned, it simply won't do to bundle all of human testimony into one gigantic division problem, as though we had in the numerator account of all the times anyone has ever testified truly to something, and then the denominator account of all the times anyone has ever testified to something, and we take the numerator over the denominator, and whatever fraction that comes out is the sort of average human mendacity quotient or something. This is how frequently people speak truly when they testify divided by the total number of times. The fact about testimony that is most interesting is that testimony is not simply something that occurs in a vacuum like that. There can be stronger testimony and weaker testimony. After all, if someone testifies to something and is wrong, either the person testifying knows that what he is saying is wrong, in which case he's lying, or he does not know that what he is saying is false, in which case he's deceived. So we have to look at the circumstances. And when we look at the circumstances with regard to the resurrection, we discover something very interesting. How could they be deceived as to whether their intimate friend with whom they had been discoursing, sleeping, eating, sitting at his feet for years, their rabbi, their teacher, was the person now speaking to them, was the person they were now seeing up close? That just doesn't even bear thinking. It's unthinkable that they could have honestly mistaken him for someone else. Well, how about dishonesty? Here, the context of their proclamation makes it wildly unlikely that they would have said this knowing that it was false, because what they were doing was inviting the combined wrath of the Jewish leadership and the Roman authorities to come down on them. And doing so on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, at ground zero, in the very place where both of those powers had conspired to have Jesus crucified. If what they were saying was false, this was simply an elaborate way to get themselves killed in some extremely unpleasant fashion. If what they were saying was something that they could easily be deceived about, we might think that they had been mistaken. But what they were proclaiming was something that, of which Peter says very boldly, we are all witnesses. So the only way to try to get away from this is going to be to try to attack the grounds of the claim that the documents tell us what some of the earliest witnesses said. That's a separate discussion. But Hume's argument is not going to do anything for us in terms of settling that, because Hume's argument is just mistaken on multiple points.
While I had Tim McGrew at my disposal, I asked Bethel to put at least one more question to him, this time an objection I'd frequently heard from a well-known skeptical New Testament historian, Bart Ehrman, who argues that positing a resurrection as an explanation takes you outside the realm of historical inquiry.
So, talk about this notion that history and theology have to be non-overlapping magisteria. You know, this quote from Bart, you've moved from history to theology the minute that you start bringing out the miraculous as a historical explanation. And probably his guys are going to go find some, they might even find some clip of Bart saying that and juxtapose. I don't know how that'll work out.
You cannot have a resurrection without there being a miracle, which means that God intervened in history, and there is no historian on the planet who's a bona fide historian who talks about God intervening in history. It just doesn't happen.
The fundamental historical claim that Christians are making is that theology and history are not completely separate domains, that there are places where God has entered history decisively, visibly, and that we can know this. And in fact, that we can know this by means of the ordinary way that we verify other historical facts. When you begin to set up the walls to try to keep God out of history, the first thing that you have to do is to dismiss the actual claims of the first century documents from the people who were closer to the facts than we are. And that's always risky if the documents come from people who have a lot to lose if what they're saying is wrong, who are testifying to something about which it's really hard to see how they could be wrong, who are close up to these facts, and especially if the documents intersect and overlap one another in ways that give us reason for believing that they are giving us testimony, that they're reporting that which they have seen and heard. As far as the notion that the domains of theology and history have to be non-overlapping, it does remind me a bit of Stephen Jay Gould's approach to the relationship between religion and science, that we have here two areas of thought, that the idea of religion is to tell us how to go to heaven, and the idea of science is to tell us how the heavens go. And when you port that over into the history theology discussion, I think it's absolutely pernicious. Again, come back to the fundamental question. If you take this kind of a view and you are wrong, how are you going to find out? It's a very bad idea to allow ourselves to use trapdoor thinking, where we lock ourselves on some matter of fact into a position, and then we wall off from ourselves anything that could serve as evidence to show us if we are wrong. I don't mind if someone says I'm cynical. I don't object if he says, well, you're really going to have to show me some evidence there. But when someone says, in principle, I am committed to letting no evidence shake me out of my position, then we have a problem.
Thanks to Tim, Bethel, and Lydia McGrew for their family input into today's episode. I believe a new generation of scholars, thinkers, apologists, and theologians are unearthing a whole set of new reasons for us to take the Bible seriously, and most especially its central claims about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. But for the last two millennia, most people have not had access to this wealth of research and scholarship. They have simply read, repeated, and passed on the words of the creed handed down to them that they believe in a Jesus who suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. He descended to the dead. On the third day, he rose again. And as that set of beliefs has been shared from generation to generation, it's been accompanied by a core reason, a very direct form of testimony of why many people have trusted in the resurrection of Jesus, as Lisa Fields of the Jude 3 Project shares.
My proof of the resurrection is actually the transforming work in my life. Like, that is that I know that the resurrection exists because of the transformation work in my life and that Jesus is alive. I could go and walk through, you know, proofs for the resurrection, but for me, that all falls short if it hasn't transformed me. And I think sometimes when I'm in the midst of my suffering, my therapist told me this once. She was like, we focus so much on the suffering that we forget that there's actual resurrection. And so in the midst of my suffering, I look to the resurrection for the hope to keep going. And if the resurrection didn't happen, I have no hope for the continuing of the faith, which is what Paul says. If there is no resurrection, like there is no hope for to keep going. And so every time I see a Christian that keeps going, that is to me another layer of proof that he actually got up. And so that's how my response to the resurrection is.
For me, the most magical part of being involved in apologetics, the rational defense of Christian faith, is seeing when both the head and the heart come together in someone's life, leading to a dramatic change in attitude and lifestyle. This was certainly the journey of the first followers of Jesus, as the dawning awareness of what had happened on the first Easter morning changed their life, and they went on to change the world. But it still happens today. Coming to believe in a Jesus of history who lived, died, and was raised from death is rarely a purely intellectual pursuit. It's often accompanied by an emotional, experiential, perhaps psychological set of experiences that lead to a change of mind and heart. This was the story of my contemporary at Oxford University, James Orr, who we met earlier on in today's show. As we heard, as a classicist, able to read the New Testament in its original Greek, James had become intrigued by the discovery of a real historical Jesus of Nazareth, a journey that would lead him to test whether the Christ of history may also be the Christ of today. Having graduated and embarked upon a promising career in law, James was nevertheless beginning to ask himself existential questions about the purpose of his life. The experience came to a head on New Year's Eve 2002, when for the first time in his life, he tried something new: praying.
And there was this niggling sense of, you know, what is this all about? So it was the existential sort of impact of those few months that led to that prayer on New Year's Eve 2002. We're at a ski resort up. We're in Verbier in Switzerland, and I'd hit the town that night with my brother, and it was a pretty raucous night, and had far too much to drink. So it wasn't just a skeptical prayer. It was a pretty drunken prayer. But I think it was a sense of, oh my gosh, you know, is this really what I'm, you know, is this, I suppose, you know, the end of the year is a natural point at which you just sit back and reflect and so on. I prayed the prayer, and just as I was drifting off, I had a very clear image in my mind of my hand reaching out of a sort of dark pit into a larger hand, like a sort of handshake, but a large hand, as it were, pulling me up, and then boom, out. Thought no more about it. And I woke up with a terrible headache. I'd forgotten to shut the curtains. All the sun was reflecting off the snow. And I remember stretching for one of these old Nokia phones. Don't know if you ever had one.
Yeah, I did.
I don't know if you remember that when you turn it on, there was this image of...
Oh, the two hands coming together.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do, hands. Yeah.
And I thought, oh my goodness, that's very odd. That is exactly the picture that I had, just in sort of humor form. I thought no more of it.
Okay.
Went off up the mountains that morning. We'd had a ski guide who was taking us down this very nasty route. The storm, terrible storm. My father froze at this stretch of black ice, and my sister and I went on bombing down the slope. We shouldn't really have done it, and left the guide behind. We were hurtling down this slope, and I suddenly shouted, visibility was very limited, and I shouted out to my sister, stop, we've got to stop, and we screeched to a halt. And the mist cleared, and it turned out we were on the top of a flat-roofed chalet. We were about 2 meters from a 12-foot drop onto sharp rocks, jagged rocks. It wouldn't have killed us, but I think it would have been very messy.
Yeah.
And my sister was sort of astonished and said, what was that? How did you know to stop? I said, well, I just had got a feeling we had to stop. And so we had edged our way around, and we climbed down this sort of drain pipe and just settled in the snow, waiting for my dad. The mist cleared again, and I saw in front of me an 8-foot-high wooden crucifix just propping up this house. And I turned to my sister and I said, what on earth is, what's that doing there? And what is that? She said, well, it's a cross. It's a Jesus cross. And I said, yes, but what's it doing there? I mean, it's propping up this house. She said, oh, well, I don't know. It's very odd, but you know, that's what it is. You know, how do you know how to stop? And we kept talking. So those little two little incidents, I thought, gosh, there's, I asked God to reveal himself to me 10 hours ago. And I've had these two very strange, but incidents that it's rational. The rational thing to do is to dismiss these, but to kind of take note of them.
Yes.
Anyway, I then sort of prayed another skeptical prayer, and then these things kept happening. And okay. There's another sort of half dozen of them, but some of them were just, it got to the point mid-February 2003 where I came to the conclusion that it was becoming irrational of me to deny the cumulative weight of these coincidences.
James says that these signs stopped almost as suddenly as they'd begun, but led him to investigating the evidence for Christianity with renewed vigor, devouring scholarly books alongside Bible reading.
Well, it's quite odd, really. I just got obsessed with the New Testament, and particularly, you know, the quest for the historical Jesus, historicity. I mean, all the classics suddenly, all the classical stuff I'd done suddenly turned, and I suddenly turned to this question of historicity and apologetics, sort of New Testament apologetics, I suppose.
So was that sort of being done in concert with talking it through with people who had some expertise in this area? Or,
you know, I didn't speak to a soul. I didn't know who to talk to. I would go along to these courses, but of course they were a disaster because
you knew twice as much as everyone there.
it was the oddest experience to walk into a church really for the first time, and you're often the first sessions in those courses are thinking about the historicity of that, and I had a lot of views, and my people in my group were a little bewildered and put off by this young Turk kind of coming in and just a know-it-all, as it were. So I just sort of turned inward and I did what I'm used to, what was used to doing. I just bought all the books that I possibly could and I read them all through, starting with New Testament, the people of God, and Jesus and the Victory of God, resurrect all of Tom Wright's stuff and Jimmy Dunn's stuff and Larry Hurtado and John Meyer. And I just got everything. F.F. Bruce's little book, New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? I think that was the first one I read. Mm. And I absolutely loved it. I mean, it was odd behavior. I mean, this was not, as it were, living the Christian faith particularly, but it was, I suppose, that the Holy Spirit was working on me in some way to give me this fascination.
Where was that coming from? Why do you think you wanted to kind of engage historically, if you like, the person of Jesus so very strongly? Yes. I mean,
I think that was partly intellectual pride, coupled with the fact that I was in almost all my various situations up until that point in a functionally secular and atheistic community, whether it was at Balliol, whether it was at school, whether it was at law school, whether it was with my family. And so my posture was immediately a defensive one, just because I didn't know any Christians. Mm. I mean, I knew no, as it were, committed Christians at all. So this was, and my behavior was extremely strange and very unsettling for my family and very unsettling for my friends.
You were becoming a bit of a fundamentalist or something?
Well, I immediately stopped. I stopped smoking. I stopped drinking. The desire just vanished.
Right.
My lifestyle did change very dramatically, even though I wasn't really
part of the church community at that point. You weren't,
not particularly, no. But my lifestyle changed dramatically. I'd like to think I wasn't too much of a sort of holier than thou Puritan, but I just did. People noticed a change, and my family were particularly were concerned. I started going to HTB. Mm. HTB was a fabulous community for me because I got plugged into one of their pastorates, their fortnightly groups, and I started to meet authentic, committed, charismatic evangelical Christians, and I was, overwhelmingly impressed by them as people. I suddenly saw a kind of quality of friendship between people and a quality of relationship between married couples or engaged couples, so that I thought, this is real, that there's something self-authenticatingly true about this community. Very, very difficult to put that into words.
Sure.
Often people would mistake it for a sort of smiley niceness.
Yeah.
But there was a bit of that, I suppose. Yeah. But it was just the real deal, and I thought, you can't convince me otherwise here. You can't fake this.
Yeah.
That was a very important moment, period for me, because I suddenly realized that this is, as it were, leading aside the intellectual case, this is actually livable in a way that is just strikes me as true and authentic. So I think without that community at HTB, I don't think I suspect I'd have petered out, and right. It would have become a kind of matter of intellectual assent.
Yes.
But as it were, with zero, ultimately, very little existential application. Yeah.
Through a further series of providential circumstances, James eventually felt called to leave his law career and begin a postgraduate degree in philosophy of religion at Cambridge. Today, he is Associate Professor of Philosophy of Religion at the Faculty of Divinity at the University of Cambridge. And ironically, the rise of New Atheism was what helped to fuel his change in career in the mid-2000s. So did that sort of play in? I mean, did that present any kind of major challenge to your newfound faith?
not at all. It turbocharged it.
Oh, right.
It really did. And I know it's sort of kind of a fashionable cliche to say, oh, gosh, you know, those new atheist arguments were so poor. But I was immediately struck by the poverty of their arguments in a way that excited me. I thought, this is fantastic. It blows open a conversation and an argument that is just eminently winnable on all fronts. But I remember one conversation in particular with an atheist friend who I think has now converted, actually, or he's very close to it, and running through the arguments, historicity of the resurrection, and looking at all of the different approaches to that. And I remember him saying, well, look, I don't care really what the evidence is. Dead people stay dead. And this was a sort of Damascene moment for me, because I realized that actually you could develop as powerful a historical case as you liked, but as I now learned from Swinburne and others, if the a priori, you know, if your priors are low, but there might be a god who would want and have reason to leave his authenticating signature in some dramatic and public highly disseminable way in history, then obviously you're going to be say that it's more rational to commit to be committed to the claim that all truth is scientific truth and that biological death is death. Mm. And that was I'm really grateful to that friend, because I suddenly realized that I was on the wrong turf dialectically. Mm. That the New Testament, this New Testament historicity stuff was fascinating, but it was important, but it was not really in this day and age where the battle is to be fought. It's, as I now realize, it's Christian evidences, yeah, not natural theology.
Yes.
And so then that coupled with the God delusion coming out, and then the Dawkins stuff, and then the Harris stuff, and all of that. And I was again amazed at, even with my relatively limited understanding of philosophy at that point, I was amazed at the weakness of the arguments.
As James says, echoing Tim McGrew's thoughts earlier, if someone is committed to trapdoor thinking, that a purely naturalistic explanation of history is the only game in town, then no amount of evidence will ever be able to persuade them that a miracle like the resurrection occurred. But as we'll explore in some forthcoming acts of this docu-series, I believe the scientific materialism of a previous generation is starting to wane, and as people open the door to the possibility of God, perhaps we will yet see more people open to the idea of the resurrection as an explanation of our world. It feels like if there ever were a candidate in history that a miracle of this nature may have happened to, it might just be the person who claimed to be the incarnate Son of God and who launched a movement that went on to transform the entire world.
The incarnation, the life, death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth was not an ordinary sequence of historical events, but they were at least historical events. Mm. And their self-authenticating power as revealing God's will and God's intentions presuppose their historicity. That is to say, any Barthian claim that this is just a revelation that we must humble ourselves before simply makes no sense if that revelation is not framed in some way that makes it accessible to us as beings caught up in the processes of history.
Perhaps we may yet see more surprising stories like that of James Orr, the classicist who was surprised to find Jesus stepping out of the pages of history into his own life. Of course, not everyone will have the same kind of personal experiences that fueled James's search for the truth about Jesus. So what do we do with someone like Douglas Murray, who says,
I think I'd need to hear a voice.
Many Christians would also appreciate a booming voice from the heavens to confirm their faltering faith from time to time. However, I would argue that all of us, Murray included, do have access to the voice of God in a very powerful way. I hope that Murray will look again at the Bible, not just for its psychological and literary value, not just as a book of deep symbolism and meaning, but which can ultimately be treated as a useful fiction, I hope he will look again at its historical pedigree, for there is ever-increasing historical evidence that the Gospels really do relay the real words and history of Jesus of Nazareth, words which, as Murray himself admits, have miraculously and irrevocably shaped everything in the world that he holds dear. What clearer voice could we ask for? To me, the stories of David Suchet, James Orr, Molly Worthen, and countless others demonstrate that the Bible cannot be picked up, admired, and then merely set aside. History itself hinges on the reality of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Somehow, in him, all the hopes, dreams, and fears of humankind once found their meeting place and continue to do so today. That, after all, is the radical claim at the center of the whole story. You've been listening to The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, telling the story of how new atheism grew old and secular thinkers are considering Christianity again. Material from The Unbelievable Show was used by permission of Premier. Visit premierunbelievable.com for full shows or today's show notes for links to all archive materials used in this episode. And just to remind you, this podcast series is also a book. You can read the first chapter for free when you join my newsletter at justinbriley.com, where you can also order the book or get a signed copy. Supporting via Patreon or tax-deductible giving from the USA will give you early access to new episodes of the podcast and access to bonus content. Find out more and how to support these efforts of mine to bring thinking faith to the secular and Christian world at justinbriley.com. Again, the links are with today's show. Coming up next time, that long-awaited public conversation between myself and historian Tom Holland. What a joy it was to be joined by some 600 people in London for a wonderful event, in which you'll hear Tom speaking, perhaps more candidly than he ever has before, about some of the personal experiences, including a cancer diagnosis, that changed the way he thinks about God and Christianity. As mentioned, you don't need to wait. You can get access to the conversation video right now when you become a silver or gold supporter. Today's episode was a production of Think Faith in partnership with Genexis and support from the Jerusalem Trust. Editing assistance by Isaac Simmons. You can find links to the book and all our featured guests with the show notes. Please subscribe to this podcast, do rate and review us, tell others, share it on social media. It really helps others to find out about it. And again, you can get access to my conversation with Tom Holland in London 2 weeks early when you support now at justinbriley.com. Again, the links are with today's show. See you next time. Thanks for listening. Just before I let you go, I had this lovely review from Chrissy saying, "So good. I've literally consumed this podcast in 3 days. I've sent it to all my friends from various backgrounds. I pray you guys continue the amazing work and keep those episodes coming." Leaving a review like Chrissy really helps others to discover the show. But if you'd really like to help me keep those episodes coming, why not consider supporting the show or buying the book that this podcast is based on? The links are with today's show. Or visit justinbriley.com. See you at the next episode.